And good evening. It's 7 o'clock, and you're listening to KRNN. Oh, nope, KTOO. 104.3 News Juno. And welcome this evening to One Lutheran UUNU. I am Sue Belita. I am the pastor of Resurrection Lutheran Church downtown, and sitting in the booth with me is
Pat McClear, who is a member of the Juno
Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
And sorry, Pat, I didn't have your mic all the way up on that, so go ahead and say that again.
Okay, and I am Pat McClear, and I am a member of the Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship.
That's great. And so, our goal this evening is to provide a safe and civil and open space for dialogue around issues of faith, conversations around issues of faith. But we would like to remind you that neither Pat nor I speak for all Lutherans or all Unitarian Universalists across all time and across all contexts.
Amen.
We do, however, bring our backgrounds, perspectives, and experiences to this conversation. And so tonight's topic, I tried to think of a way of summarizing it. We thought that because this is the first conversation that you've been a part of, mm-hmm. that we would talk a little bit about our journeys. And so I thought about faith homes.
Ah.
And so how did you come to your faith expression? Were you born into a faith expression? Have you moved into a different faith expression? And why do you stay into the faith expression that you're in at this point? So to let the listeners know, you're invited into this conversation. And if you would like to listen for a little bit and get your perspective in this, give us a call at 463-6455. And so, faith homes.
Faith expression. Try to say that three times fast.
Well, I try to be careful not to. Yeah. Try to keep everybody in. So, you know,
we try
to make it bigger than that.
And that's appreciated. I was born and raised in the Catholic Church and educated by nuns for 12 years.
Well, there's an education in and of itself,
you betcha.
Right?
So I tell people that I was raised by nuns and and loved them dearly and wanted to be one for the longest time.
So did I.
Ah! Now, a Catholic nun or an Episcopalian nun or a Buddhist nun?
I did not
nun?
Know.
Okay.
That there were denominations. All I knew is that I was a really religious little girl. And the only religious women that I saw were nuns.
Oh.
So, I saw Sally Field be a nun, mm-hmm. and I saw mm-hmm. the Trouble with Angels. Mm-hmm. And so those were the models that I had for what it meant to be a religious woman.
And I only thought that Catholics had nuns. I didn't realize that other faith communities had women religious. And I was totally flabbergasted when I realized that. The Catholic nuns weren't the only nuns on the planet. And,
right.
And that
but
was
there was
a
something that inspired you that you thought you wanted to be a nun?
Well, as a child, as you described yourself, I was very religious. And I would actually walk home from school by myself. And during Lent, I would have my rosary beads in my mm-hmm. pocket and I would pray. And during Lent, while the other kids were at recess, I was at Mass, and after school on Fridays, I would be at the Stations of the Cross, and
So you had a really deep faith formation.
I did.
And so I'm guessing your family was Catholic.
Absolutely. Both my parents, and there were six of us, all of whom were baptized in the church that my parents were married in. And my sister Mary, when I was going into the sixth grade, she entered the convent, mm. and so I was on cloud nine because Mary was living my dream, and
yeah.
I most certainly was living vicariously through her. Yes. So when you describe yourself as religious, what did that look like?
So as a little kid, what did that mean? And when you started to say, as I was walking home from school, I walked home from school by myself, I would sing parts of the liturgy. So,
in liturgy being
I would sing
Lutheran?
Parts of the service, right.
Okay.
So, glory be to the Father, mm-hmm. and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost. It was ghost back
mm-hmm.
then.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I would sing the parts of the Sunday service to myself as I would walk home. And loved all the extra things, Sunday school and vacation mm-hmm. Bible schools. And when I would go visit my grandmother, I would go to her church's vacation Bible school. And so when my parents stopped going to church, I kept on.
And how old were you then?
That was sixth and seventh grade. And so by seventh grade, I was making sure that I was going to church. They would take me and drop me off if I wanted to go, which I did. And so I was just a churchy kid.
Where other kids were saying, "God, yay, my parents don't want to go anymore.
Right, I don't have to go anymore.
And I can read the paper and have breakfast and sleep in."
Well, you know, we moved around a lot. That's one of the things about faith homes.
Mm.
So we moved around a lot. We weren't military, but my dad chased better jobs. And schools would change, teachers would change, but the church was a constant.
Yeah.
So we would move into a new community, and I would immediately have this safe, familiar, mm-hmm. comfortable place to go to. And that really, that meant a lot to me.
When you were going to your church and your parents would drop you off, did other adults in the community like try to mentor you or adopt you or guide you?
And
or did
isn't
they
that
say,
interesting, because I've heard so many stories of people that's happened to, that, you know, the older people in the congregation. And I don't know if because we did tend to move frequently, mm-hmm. I never really had that experience. When I got into high school, there was a youth group. And so I got into the youth group, and that formed a community for me. But I never did have that mentoring kind of reaching out at all. So, yeah, it was me and God. It was me and the service. And it really was between me and whatever that experience was.
My second grade teacher may have been 4 feet tall, and she was probably 400 years old. I mean, she was just this ancient little woman. And the high school that I went to, the convent, was attached to the high school,
mm-hmm.
and this nun was retired at that convent by the time I got to high school. And one day she grabbed me outside the chapel, and she wanted to talk to me about my vocation,
mm-hmm.
and whether or not I was going to hear what God had to say, and whether or not I was
in second grade.
No, she was my second grade teacher.
Oh, okay.
But when I was in high school,
she
had retired,
and
so she was hanging out by the chapel, jumping on. No, but she did. She stopped me, and there was another nun in high school who definitely would. She was one who I would talk to about that, whether or not that vocation was something for me to aspire to. Because I certainly, in middle school, when I was in eighth grade, I wrote an essay on my vocation for the Knights of Columbus. And I was awarded first prize for my essay on why I was going to be a nun. And at the time, my sister Mary never took her final vows. She, the Sisters of Mercy are academic teachers, and Mary's not an academic. But anyway, when Mary came out of the convent, and when I won that contest, my mother, who did not have a fondness for religious, went up to my teacher, my nun, who was the teacher at the time, and said, "Damn you, you won't get another one."
Oh, my goodness. All right,
oh,
then.
Yeah. Could the floor please open
so I could
drop through? Yeah, so my mother had no fondness for the nuns, and I think it was always a battle between she and them over her kids. But at any rate, that didn't deter me. That didn't deter me.
And yet, you are not a nun today.
I am not a nun today.
Have you ever been a nun?
I have not.
Neither have I.
Yeah, here we are.
Here we are.
And I often think, you know, if they could see me now, when I got to college and I started feeling rather uncomfortable at Mass, and I think part of that was it was in the early 70s, and the women's movement was definitely on the rise, and I became more aware of feminism and more aware of my own sexuality, and then that patriarchal theology just was not resonating any longer for me. And I explored other faith beliefs, but again, nothing was was clicking for me. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So about how long then did you not really have a faith connection?
Like at least 10 years, I think.
That's a pretty long journey.
Yeah.
I ended up going to a Catholic college. They offered me a scholarship.
You've
got
to take it. Yeah. If the Catholics are giving away money, grab it.
But an interesting thing was, as a Lutheran, I do remember being very particularly shaped by not being Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
So we did not cross ourselves because Catholics crossed ourselves. We did not kneel because Catholics knelt. And so much of my understanding of what it meant to be a Lutheran really was shaped by, it's not this. So it was fascinating to go then to a Catholic college, and I did not feel like I could go to Mass because I was a good Lutheran until Lent came. See, it's that interesting. Lent is an interesting seasonal moment in lives of liturgical churches.
Introspective
it
and
is,
quiet.
It is. And I felt like I had to go to worship during from Ash Wednesday and Lent. And, of course, I found out that, you know, we're kissing cousins and nothing awful happened in the Mass and I could follow it and it was, you know, it was great and welcoming. And it was a college Mass.
Yeah,
and,
right, yeah,
you know,
right.
Father
so
Kiefer was, there were people playing guitars. It was
absolutely
the age of Godspell and the liturgical dance.
Okay.
So, yeah, although I did roll my eyes even then a little bit. But it was an opportunity, like you said, to explore something other. And there have been other times in my life when I've explored other faith traditions or been invited to other faith traditions. And, you know, that whole notion of it's interesting to ask people in our congregations or in our gatherings, you know, yes, this is how you've come to this moment, but why do you stay? And that usually is the more important question.
Mm-hmm.
And some people stay out of habit. Some people stay out of a true connection. Some people stay because it takes energy to change things. You know, I mean, there are many reasons but people don't necessarily consciously process why it is that they stay. So you talked about there were some reasons that kind of came to a fullness about not wanting to stay any longer in that Catholic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as we tell our stories about where we started, our own journeys and transitions, where we are now, please feel free to join in the conversation at 463-6455 if you want to get a call. Give us a call and share your story a little bit about why it is that you are in the faith place that you are now. So you
are not in a faith place.
Or not in a faith place. Because, again, there you were for 10 years of not feeling a connection with anything organized. Did you feel still a connection with God in the middle of that time?
I don't know that I would use the word God, but certainly an acknowledgement of a higher power, of a mystery. And there were some gatherings with like-minded folks in terms of earth-based theologies and Wiccan stuff and that was nice but it was work because we always had to do our own rituals. It's not like there was an established community, a church, a temple, a synagogue, a mosque. You know, you had to figure
with
it out.
Patterns,
absolutely. And certainly there's a calendar, but that was lovely while that happened. That was lovely while it would happen. But I did have, which listeners would appreciate because we all have had, an NPR driveway moment.
There you go. And thank you for the great drama. Ladies and gentlemen, an NPR driveway moment shared by Pat.
So I'm driving home from work and the reporter is talking about Unitarian Universalism, which I had never heard of when the nuns taught comparative religion. And even on the East Coast, I mean, really? Hello, where did UU start in the United States? In Massachusetts. And there's one down the street from the school, but it wasn't on the radar.
Right.
It was not on the radar. So the reporter was talking about it and how different congregations, what they needed to go through to be welcoming communities. And
I love that you made air quotes around welcoming. This is radio. They couldn't see that. But so I'm lifting that up, that
okay,
you put air quotes around the welcoming.
I did. It's a term that doesn't have a strong definition. But
I've heard welcoming means letting people in as long as they're like you.
Okay. See? Right. There you go. So A to B. There's a big continuum on the welcoming thing. But that the president of the Unitarian Universalist at the time, head of the association, had made a statement that homophobia wasn't a sin, was a sin, and homosexuality was not. And that's when I had to sit in the driveway. I mean, I couldn't get out of the car. I had to continue listening to what this man was talking about and what really, really? And so when it was done and I got out of the car and I immediately, really and true, I immediately went to the Yellow Pages and I said, where can I find one of these churches? Hmm. And the next Sunday I was sitting in the back row and I've been going ever since. And that was 20 years ago. And I have been sitting in there ever since.
But so, not in the back row so much. No,
not anymore. Not anymore. Now, as I said, if the nuns could see me now,
right.
Because we're a lay-led fellowship, and I am one of the lay leaders.
Could you explain a little bit more about that? I'm not sure that many of our listeners, I think we've heard of Universal Unitarians.
Well,
what does it mean? So lay-led.
lay-led is, quite frankly, we have a very small fellowship and we can't afford clergy.
All right. So, but there are some congregations that have
clergy.
Oh, my
goodness. There's huge congregations.
Okay.
And when, for instance, in the end of this month in Portland, there'll be the General Assembly for the Unitarian Universalist Association. And I've attended one before. And you go in to a session, and the person sitting next to you is talking about how they have three services every Sunday.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
and that, exactly.
It doesn't
hello?
Matter the denomination. It doesn't matter the expression. There's always whipping it out to see who's
the
bigger.
Oh, my gosh. And I'm sitting there going, really?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
And, you know, here we are, very isolated, at least down south, a small congregation might be on a road system,
right.
And so they can swap people every once in a while. But so here, we are lay-led, and as I said, I'm one of the lay leaders with a handful of other folks. And we also welcome folks to come and do a service. So Dov had been here before, and he very kindly would do Easter services for us. He wasn't busy, anyway, you know. And it was lovely. It was lovely. And people were so appreciative.
What does the parts mean, though? What does a Unitarian,
well,
what
historically,
does that mean?
Historically, instead of the Trinity, it was Unitarian. There's one God.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't, it wasn't the three, Father, Son, Holy Ghost or spirit, depending on where you're headed. And the Universalist was that everybody's going to heaven and there's no goats and sheep here. So then the two came together in the 50s, the 1950s, to form the Unitarian Universalist. But it has evolved over that time, so it's not necessarily some people who participate are indeed Christian, but many are not, and that works.
And part of my understanding is that it's very centered around social ministry, social justice.
Social justice is huge, yes. And that instead of, so one of the seven principles under which we work, and one of which is a free and responsible search for meaning. So there isn't any dogma that you're signing on to at the bottom line. There isn't a dogma to sign on to. So on any given Sunday, you don't know what you're going to walk into necessarily.
Well, I'll tell you, same is true for the Lutheran Church.
Okay. And that no one's telling you what to believe. No one's telling you. And that we're encouraging each other to spiritual growth, however that is seen for you, however that manifests for you. And that there's an inherent worth and dignity to all people. And so when we we here in Juneau have gone through what it takes to be a welcoming community. And it was a hard journey because there were a lot of discussion and some people, there were a lot of new things that people had to wrap their heads around in regards to LGBTQ stuff. And quite frankly, we did it probably 10 years ago, and the huge changes that are going on socially in our society, and we'll probably have to address that being a welcoming community
mm-hmm.
again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's probably fodder for a radio show
mm-hmm.
in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did not mean to be flip about welcoming being, you know, those who are most like us, but it does challenge congregations or any gathering. What does it mean? Where's your center?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can you richly work together as a diverse group of people around whatever that center is? And if the center is a social justice center,
mm-hmm.
then you can say we can set aside our differences to be able to work towards this common goal. Or if our center is the love of Jesus Christ
mm-hmm.
through
mm-hmm.
God and the Holy Spirit, then you can say a whole lot of people who believe different things about and vote differently and order different kinds of pizzas and all those kinds
mm-hmm.
of things, they can come together. So what does that welcome mean? Who's the welcomer? You know,
mm-hmm.
is it the congregation? Is it the philosophy of the congregation? What creates that welcome? So, yes, it can be something that I think has to be very intentionally discussed
yes.
as a
yes.
part of why people find that as their faith home
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
oftentimes why people leave
yes.
some place as a
yes.
faith home because
yes.
the welcome doesn't match the way they experience
mm-hmm.
the welcome.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's my sister Mary, who was in the Sisters of Mercy and has long time ago left. I mean, she's grandmother now.
Uh-huh.
But she is still a member of the same parish that we were raised in. And she, social justice is right there for her. She works very hard. She's a tireless volunteer to make in terms of St. Vincent de Paul in our
yeah,
hometown.
Well,
and
you know, historically, it's been denominations across all kinds of faith expressions that have been very active partners
mm-hmm.
in social
mm-hmm.
justice
absolutely.
Absolutely.
Causes. So there are times that she and I have had conversation about my no longer sharing those that faith with her, but we share the social justice stuff.
Right.
And then the controversy around things within the Catholic Church and politics and she has been quite forthcoming in saying all that is periphery in her relationship is with Jesus and that's social justice and what needs to happen.
Right.
And that other stuff is to the side.
And so that's why she stayed.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
I think every church has their crisis
mm-hmm.
moment, or every religious faith has their crisis moment. And individuals have those crisis moments in the midst of that, too. And there's no denying that I think some of the things that were privileged and kept quiet across more than one denomination, those barriers have been broken, and we're examining what does
mm-hmm.
it mean to be people of faith.
Yes.
But
yes.
that has been a hard bar for people to wrestle with. How do I remain part of an institution that has acted badly, whether that's the Catholic Church
mm-hmm.
or the Lutheran Church
exactly.
or the Jewish Church or, you know, any
yep.
of those,
yep.
Jewish temple.
Yep.
So, yes. So that is a fundamental question then, whether it's our own journeys, our own understandings, or our own relationship with the larger denominational expression, why do we stay connected? Why do we find a new home? I mean, something mattered to you. When you heard that
mm-hmm.
that story,
mm-hmm.
it was like, this is a place where I can
yes. Yes.
live
yes.
out my faith
yes.
again.
Yes. And I had a void
mm.
within me, and I recognized it. I acknowledged it. I didn't suppress it. I felt it, and I I wanted to be in community.
Right.
I wanted to be in community. Certainly not the way I wanted it when I was in sixth grade, but I feel I wanted to be in community. And I'm so grateful that it was found.
Yeah.
It was found.
So if you have a moment where you wrestled with why are you staying in your faith tradition, or a story about how your faith tradition has helped sustain you so that you've wanted to stay, feel free to give us a call at 463-6455. The lines are open, as they say. And it's not even pledge week.
It's not even, yeah, go for it. So I'm curious about, Sue, about your path to ministry in the befores and afters of that tap on the shoulder, that whisper in the ear, that...
Yeah, and so I say the first time I picked up papers to go to seminary, admission forms to go to seminary, it was in the early 80s, and we'd been living in Utah, and there's a very interesting dynamic of being something other than of the LDS Church.
Mm-hmm.
When you live
mm-hmm.
in Utah, your faith community becomes your social community. Because if you are other, when you're living in the Salt Lake area, then the others gather together.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
how we do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became very active. Our social group, our Sunday group, our, you know, all the women who had kids my age, and, you know, we of that church banded together. So it became a lived everyday walk of walking with that community. And so I applied, I got the paperwork, and, you know, it was just one of those moments where I felt that tug, but I had a new child and a marriage and was working, and it just wasn't right at the time. And I kind of just set it aside and became very active in my career, became a sign language interpreter and teacher, and we moved, and I would teach there, and we moved, and I would teach somewhere else, and wrote books, and did all of the stuff that you were supposed to do, presented at conferences, and, you know, got, like I say, got published and got the degrees, and you know, thought that I was this rising star in the profession, and at the same time still going to church all along. And the profession ended up disappointing me. It was one of those things where I felt like I was always striving.
And
for every milestone that I would achieve, there was always something more to do. There was always this notion of striving. Academic settings make are artificially stressful that way, I think, as well as being legitimately stressful that way. So I was at a departmental meeting, striving.
As you were expected to do.
As I was expected to do. But it was an uphill battle. I was fighting a losing battle, but I was fighting it quite valiantly and faithfully and frustratingly. And there was this, I speak of it as a voice that was inside of me. It wasn't a voice with a voice, though. It was words
mm-hmm.
without a voice, but it was there. And all I know is that it was of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I know. And in the midst of this departmental meeting, those words were, "This is not your place."
Whoa.
And I was so excited.
Somebody recognized it.
Yes, but I went home to my husband and said, "I'm not supposed to be an academic at this institution. I'm supposed to be an academic at some other institution."
Ah.
See, it was the, you know, no prophet is recognized in their own. And I'd been at this institution for too long. I needed to go somewhere else. Geographic change always makes it better,
uh-huh.
right?
Grass is greener, grass is greener.
And so I did. I began applying at other institutions because I knew God was directing me to this new place. And our son had just graduated high school. It was the perfect timing. And everything, just all the stars were aligning. And I didn't get any of those jobs.
Ooh.
I was always the second.
Interesting.
Yeah. There were two finalists for several jobs.
And
I would go and I would fly there and I'd interview and do classes and the whole nine yards. And I was always the second choice. And it was very frustrating. That was probably one of the most difficult times in my life, of knowing that God had told me there was something for me to do, and it wasn't happening. And I ended up going to a conference to network and try to find a job. And I spoke with a colleague who was not active in any faith tradition, but had some questions about why does the church, because I was the churchiest thing she had, she could ask me. And I would answer these questions. And she just had this knowing. She just smiled and she said, "You're meant to go to seminary." And she pointed me. She pushed me. She shoved me. She made me promise. She was very, very determined for someone who still to this day does not go to church. But she's the reason that I went to seminary. I did not realize until she pushed that that was the new place where God said. And the minute I came home from that conference and I said to my husband, "I have to go to seminary," and he said, "I know."
And you said, "Well, thanks, honey. Yes. Why didn't you tell me a long time ago?"
Yeah, I know. No, he was wonderful and supportive and committed and dedicated to that knowing that it had been a tap on my shoulder a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I celebrate God's patience and persistence. You know, God will give us time to figure it out. And so here I am.
So do you think, like me, being a nun was what we thought was the option because females weren't welcome to be in places of leadership?
And I'm really blessed at this moment in time that the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America does ordain women. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, that was not true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I had no female role models. I did not see female pastors. And there are other religious denominations who've been ordaining women for a long time. And blessings upon those people who've been able to see that. I never saw that. I never had a youth director or a pastor or an associate pastor or any expression of women. So, yes, to be a faithful woman,
yes.
You know, who gave her life to that faith, being a nun was the only thing that was within view. So, yeah, I'm so grateful. And I must now finish by telling this story. Just very quickly, on Sunday, I was speaking with the children. We have a children's time in the midst of our service, and we were talking about hope. And I asked the kids what they were hoping for, and one little boy, hoped for presents. And so I said, "Isn't that great then when you come to church that hope is fulfilled because you get bread and you get wine and you got to work with what the kids give you, right?" You know, and one kid hopes for Legos. And I said, "Isn't that great because at the church we build things and, you know, I'm working it really hard." And I turned to this little girl and I said, "What do you hope for?" And she said, "I hope to be the pastor of the church, of this church someday." And I thought, you know, here she is in elementary school and can voice that hope and have it be a realized hope.
That's a wonderful story.
It was really great. Yeah. And so, yeah, the kinds of things that we grew up without a lot of choice and option and modeling, it really has changed today, which is one reason why I continue to stay within my denomination, because it does allow for that.
I can't think of which book it was that Sue Monk Kidd wrote, but she was with her daughter at a service where men were being ordained in, and I'm not sure what denomination she and her husband were at the time. And she said while it was happening, her daughter was tugging, and then finally she leaned down, and her daughter said, "Mommy, when is it the girl's turn? When is it the girl?" And she said it just like boing on her head and said, "Honey, there is, in this place, there is no girl's turn." And that was a moment for her to think, there's something else. And,
which is, you know, it's a very interesting dynamic for me to know that the time has turned the wheel so that there is this. Now there are these conversations, though, and I think they're faithful conversations. And again, I'm going to reach out to the radio audience. Mm-hmm. Guys, it would be really helpful to hear your voice in the midst of this, because there have been times in our worship service where I'm the pastor and the assisting minister is a female and the reader is a female and the church council member who helps serve communion is a female. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation about where are our roles, you know, mm-hmm. would that little boy who was at the children's sermon say, oh, I didn't know boys could be pastors, the way that girls mm-hmm. used to do that. Mm-hmm. So there is this interesting dynamic about how do we find our place? How do we find our voice? How do we find ourselves represented in the worship that is before us? You know, for a lot of years, it was male-dominated,
mm-hmm.
and women could have wondered, but I think there was this assumption that we just knew that we were welcome,
mm-hmm.
and that we had a part to play, and we could hear it, or did we? You know, and nowadays, when there are these women who are leading the church, do men wonder if there's a place for them? Do they stay because they see that as a diverse and rich blessing for the community of faith, or do they wonder if they have a place? So, guys, if you've got something to chip in on that one,
please do.
Boy, that would be great. 463-6455.
I think about characteristics, male, female, and somebody may argue that that feminine side is the caring and taking care of, and so this would be a natural place for women to go to,
mm-hmm.
to be that shepherd, to be that flock, and it's, but it's also interesting, as you mentioned, in Lutheran, there's, how do I say, degrees of, so in one evangelical, you women are welcome, but there are
different Lutheran expressions,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Lutheran denominations, and so the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America ordains women. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the Wisconsin Lutheran Church do not ordain women. So that's very true that, the particular denomination is the guiding factor for that.
And I think about there could be a synagogue, you know, well, if you were a Reformed versus a conservative versus, there's Orthodox, you know, it's degree of involvement by women.
And it is, it's really interesting because being a woman pastor is still an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because it's now a more accepted and just a more seen thing in the life of the world now, we're not quite as unique maybe, but we forget sometimes how startling it can be. Wearing my collar around town, usually there are some double takes,
mm-hmm.
because it's
mm-hmm.
still not an experienced way of understanding for a lot of denominations worldwide. So I'm grateful.
Yes. Oh, indeed. Liberation theology and how years, the Catholic Church tried to press that, and that was going wrong in the city of Central America. Women that I knew, nuns that I knew, who were, send money, I need a Jeep, and I'm up in the mountains of Guatemala and Central America, you know, send money, I need a Jeep. And then there was a big shift in a political movement, and so those women that educated me, one, they were highly educated.
Mm-hmm.
They had master's degrees.
Mm-hmm.
The church did not cheap out on educating these women, and they were also into liberation theology, and so they were excellent role models. They were wonderful role models.
Sure.
They were strong, intelligent women who were out there doing the work. And then the Catholic Church took a little right turn, and liberation theology was pretty much suppressed. And now Pope Francis is bringing that topic right back up again. And I think with that, the nuns on the bus, bless them. You know, they're not as many men in power who were going to in the Catholic Church who were going to tell them to park the bus and get back in the convent. You know, they've
which I find when several months ago, Deacon Charles Rohrbacher mm-hmm. was one of the people that yeah. we invited in and we talked. And one of the things that I just completely celebrate about the Catholic Church, that I think it's astonishing and wonderful and amazing that it does not have schism.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
so
yeah,
see,
yeah.
I already had to talk about yes. three different expressions, yes. and those were the main expressions of the Lutheran yep. Church. There's all bunches of other ones. Mm-hmm. In the midst of time, mm-hmm. in the midst of different ways of being, of theologies that get lifted up in terms of division, in terms of people disagreeing, in terms of what the leadership says, in the midst of all of this, the Catholic Church has remained whole. It is there's not, you know, break-off mm-hmm. types of mm-hmm. the Catholic Church. And I just, I find that to be such a gift and such a blessing. And again, you know, that great underlying why people stay, that there's something that's so satisfying and so connective and so
compelling. My sister, you know, it was like, what?
Yeah.
Because things got pretty gosh darn ugly there for a while. And you know, as she said, it's her relationship isn't with the patriarchal hierarchy. Her relationship is with Jesus and her God.
Right. And so there are so many ways that can be expressed.
Mm-hmm.
But I do. I find it absolutely goosebumpy as a Lutheran, as you know, part of the group that was the first one to say, we think we might go over here and do this, you know, that the fact that the Catholic Church has remained this immaculate whole, worldwide, global whole, in spite of all the differences and the controversies, and again, the different types of leadership, I just find it to be a true gift of faith. I just am overwhelmed sometimes by how people have managed to navigate
mm-hmm,
that staying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because honestly, the gift that Luther did was teach people how to leave.
Okay, there you go.
Like, you know, we don't agree with this, so we're going to go over here and start up our little church, and which could be very faithful. You know, the many ways that faith gets lived it's mind-boggling.
And I like to think that there's a common denominator in terms of, we were talking about the end of the Bette Midler concert, just that kind, just, you know, be kind.
Right.
And you know, that love and be kind.
Do you know, it's the interesting thing about that, though, is that that's the response. I think
okay.
that there has to be something that impels us to that response. I don't think people are kind because that is our nature. I think we're kind because we feel some larger connection outside of ourselves. And so when you talked about that time, those 10 years, that there was this void
mm-hmm.
inside
mm-hmm.
of yourself. And I do believe that faith is something that connects us to that mystery outside of ourselves, and that mystery that is a higher power, and the mystery that is community. I really do think that we're hardwired for both of those mysteries.
Certainly hardwired for the community aspect of it, because that's a survival
mm-hmm.
thing, whether it's a million years ago, physical survival or emotional psychological survival too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So that community is big. Yeah, yeah. I agree.
Yeah. So, what else could you tell about your faith journey? Because obviously, you are not from Alaska.
Why? Because of the way I say my ass. What?
When you don't say R's. I got good Midwestern R's here, baby. You don't say R's.
When I was back east and I had graduated from college and I worked, was working, and then I had a friend who was headed out to Seattle, and I said, well, what the heck? Because I was working as a teacher's aide. It's not like I had a profession, a career. And so I went out to Seattle, and then, you know, I ended up going back to school, and I'm hanging out at the UW. And then someone was going to Alaska, and I said, well, you know, I'd visit for the summer. Well, hello.
Yeah, oh, yeah, that
yeah.
story,
yeah, that
huh?
story, I know.
But were you UU at that time?
Nope. I've been here for about 30 years, and there was a time while working in the school district when I was a half-time librarian and half-time gym teacher. It wasn't the most fun year that I ever had with my career at the Juneau School District.
You were feeding bodies and feeding minds.
You betcha I was. And so I took a leave of absence, and thus I went back east for a couple of years, which was, the timing was wonderful, and I was quite grateful for the school board for allowing me that, because my mother died at the time. And so, and that was the first time in 60 years that my father had been by himself. So that the timing, and so when I asked for that second year, but it was while back east that I had that NPR moment. And I came back here. And so the church that I attended while I was back east, oh gosh, it was stunningly beautiful. It was an old, big beams, old barn, you know, and it was on acreage, and it was just so lovely. And then I get here, and, you know, it's a band of 50 people who are going from place to place to place, like, where can we be? Mm-hmm. So, you know, St. Brendan said, sure, in the afternoons you can be here. And then it was like Zach Gordon Center said, sure, on Sunday mornings you can be here. And then, oh gosh, people have been very generous in allowing us to rent and have space. And right now we're at the Temple Sukkot Shalom. They don't use it on Sunday mornings.
Right.
And so it's a wonderful partnership right
yeah.
now. Yeah, yeah.
You know, but that is another reason, I think, why people stay, that architecture has a lot to do with, you know, the faith expressions that we have. When I went to seminary, we had chapel every day, and I did not always find that to be a rich, faithful experience for me. And, you know, that's how it is for a lot of us. I think we go to church, and sometimes it speaks to us, and sometimes it doesn't. But there was a stained glass window. Actually, there were two stained glass windows, and they preached to me, and they prayed with me, those two windows. And that's what kept me going.
So at St. Brendan's, behind the altar, there's a big window that looks out to the trees in the woods, and there'd be more than once that I'd be watching, and the same thing at Chapel by the Lake, if I've been there for a concert, and watching, yes.
So very much, I mean, and that is the gift of Southeast Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
I think many of our buildings acknowledge the fact that
our environment is what it is.
The creation is all around us, and it preaches to us as well. But I do think that that is a reason that people stay maybe in the midst of a congregation that isn't necessarily feeding them in numerous ways. But, you know, this is my family pew.
Mm-hmm.
I go in here and I feel connected. Or, you know, this window has taken me through things, or I can watch the changing of the seasons through this.
Mm-hmm.
So the architecture, you know, there are many components to why we stay.
I'm grateful that at the temple they just now finished some construction, and so there are new windows, and it'll be a lot warmer in the winter. So. That makes it, there have been people actually, one woman who's like, nope, too cold, gotta go, see ya. And I can't blame her, I didn't bring a blanket.
And
so,
it is, it's so interesting because oftentimes the opposite reason, you know, why people leave, I think oftentimes the reason people say they leave is generally not the reason.
Mm-hmm,
that there's
mm-hmm,
more
mm-hmm.
to why people leave. But it could be something as simple as, it's just too cold in this space, or you know, I can never get a place where I can see, or you know, it's an interesting dynamic. I do think so many of those factors play into it beyond that, you know, necessarily the faith relationship, but the other kinds of relationships, that whether it is to the building or the ambient temperature, or you know, somebody put carrots into the Jell-O obviously supposed to be pineapple.
What was wrong with them?
We had this conversation on Sunday at church because the one person said, why do we grate carrots into Jell-O and pretend that that's salad? And I said, well, because it is. And, you know, orange Jell-O requires the orange carrots. And people were nodding, you know. And yes, and, you know, the family traditions of banana goes into red Jell-O and cottage cheese and pineapple go in the green Jell-O. And, you know, if you put cottage cheese and pineapples into the red Jell-O, it's just wrong. It's, and so that would be reason to leave. See? you don't know how to do this.
As opposed to a real crisis in faith, which is something altogether different.
So what does a typical worship service look like for you then, or a gathering?
Well, we would refer to it as a worship service, and most any UU congregation that you walk into will have a chalice that's in the front. And the chalice tradition evolved during World War II because there was social justice work going on in France and Spain to help with the resistance movement.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted some sort of symbol so people knew from whence the help was coming. And a gentleman whose name, forgive me, I don't remember, designed that chalice to say, this is who's helping you. And
that's the central symbol.
Yes,
okay.
Yes. And so what was wonderful, as I mentioned, the General Assembly will happen in Portland at the end of this month. And just like the Olympic flame goes all around, so the General Assembly chalice circulated. And we had it here in Juneau on Easter Sunday. And so it was so wonderful to have.
Nice.
And it, the weather was wonderful as well. And one person in the fellowship, she said, well, what do you do when a friend comes to visit Juneau? You take them around to see things. She hauled that huge 50-pound chalice. She brought it to the glacier, took pictures. She took it out to the Eagle Beach
like
and took pictures.
Stanley.
Oh, my gosh, exactly. And so when the gentleman from Portland who sent it, and he said, do you have any pictures to go with it? I said, I have pictures to go with it. Here you go. So that symbol of the chalice is very meaningful, and you will see that at any UU worship service, that the chalice will be, and meetings, whatever. It starts with lighting the chalice, and then take it from there. And
what does that mean, lighting the chalice? Is there a candle in it? Is the candle?
Yes.
Okay.
There is a.
So when I think of chalice, I think of
drinking
vessel.
So and that was part of the design, was that it. Most of them look like a communion vessel, but it has the light in it.
Okay.
And it was very what words do I want? It was very intentional for when he designed it.
Uh-huh.
And so meetings start with lighting the chalice. For a while, we had a part-time minister, Reverend Sarah Schur, and when we would have meetings, she'd get her iPhone and she'd say, I got the chalice because there's an app for a UU chalice so that we could always have the chalice
always there.
When we had our meetings, which cracked me up because I had no idea there was an app for UU.
There's an app for everything.
There's an app for everything, so I've learned, So, you know, we'll light the chalice and we do our welcome and we have our hymnal. Many people would open that up and say, I know this song. And then you'll read the words and say, you changed the words.
Oh.
And we go, oh, yes, we did, to make the language more inclusive. And so the faith traditions will borrow from anybody. Will borrow. So that is in the hymnal as
the
well.
Singing is a part of
absolutely,
the
service. Yes. Singing is a part. And a variety of readings and whatever the message, the topic is, depending on who is leading the service. Last week we had a student who just was promoted out of the eighth grade, and there's a program within UU which is Standing on the Side of Love, Social Justice, and her message that last Sunday was about standing on the side of love.
Hmm.
And I think you, this is it. Well, not unlike the child who spoke to you about,
right.
I hope to be the pastor someday. And
not unlike your essay on
how I wanted to
be
a nun.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. And so I just love that she, in other youth within the community are welcome to do that and have taken us up on it and have the support and the gratitude of those assembled to say, way to go, kid.
Yeah.
Thanks. And when are you going to do it again?
Right.
Yeah. And usually we have joys and concerns and we're small enough, so it doesn't have to be done in silence. People can come up and state their joys, their concerns, and then we all can respond to that, however, whether prayer or good thoughts, energy, however you want to direct it. And that's nice, too. And we always end by, we're small enough, we always end by forming a, sometimes it looks like a circle, sometimes it looks the amoeba shape, and hold hands and sing. And then, you know, we don't have yellow jello with it, but goodness knows there are folks who may have been raised in a Lutheran church.
That's
and
right.
Says, I wonder if I could sneak that yellow in here and not get busted.
Do you take up an offering?
We do. The first Sunday of every month it goes to a local nonprofit. In the past, we've done that. This year, we collected money so to send more of us down to the General Assembly, but we always will have a local nonprofit, and you know, we take our turn at the glory hole, and we adopt a Ware family, and you know, we're the best little us we can be.
There you go.
Yeah, that's grand. Yeah,
that's just grand.
So when I mentioned before the crisis in faith, about you know why you would leave.
Uh huh.
And I know for my mother when one of my sisters died of ALS, and that was quite a crisis of faith for my mother. Not for my father. I think my father was sustained by his faith.
Yes.
But my mother was mad at God because you don't bury your children. But it wasn't. She wasn't going to leave the church, but that was definitely, my sister's death was compounded then because of that faith situation, that crisis in faith. And it was a very rocky time for my mother. But like I said, she stuck with it. But I think for other people about, you know, why me?
Yeah.
And it's not fair. And so I'm out of here, you know?
And that can be. Well, I often talk about that in what is your understanding of the nature of God?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
How does God act in our lives? And that sounds to me like a great topic for another conversation. So great segue for saying thank you all for listening to this evening's debut. And so we'll rhyme the debut of One Lutheran, you, and you. Now that you have met the Lutheran again and the you, we'll be waiting next time, July 2nd, Thursday, July 2nd, again from 7 o'clock to 8 p.m., to have you join in our conversation on an issue of faith and belief. And so what a pleasure. Thank you so much,
this
Pat.
This was very nice.
For
thank
being
you.
Here. We are... just so excited to have a new way of talking about and making space for issues of faith. So thank you. And you have been listening to KTOO News Juno 104.3. Coming up, some more of the grand news programming that you have come to expect. And again, we will be doing One Lutheran, you, and you on July 2nd, first Thursday of the month, from 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock. This is Sue Belita, Lutheran pastor at Resurrection Lutheran Church, and
Pat McClear from the Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship,
and thanking you for your faithfulness as KTOO listeners. God bless, and good night. We'll say good night, Pat.
Good night.
Good night, Gracie.
Yeah. And just a reminder of your Juno weather, that it's going to be a rainy evening, a rainy weekend coming up tonight. Rain with lows around 48 degrees. Friday, there'll be rain with highs around 55 degrees. Friday night, rain continues to be likely with not a lot of change in temp, though. The lows are 45 to 51 degrees. Saturday, if you're hoping for a good day for garage sales, probably not so much. Rain is likely, as also on Sunday. So stay dry.
For and about women, tune in to KRNN FM at 102.7.